Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Do you have a sweet tooth? If so, this episode of Louisiana Eats is likely to drive you wild. We begin with a lesson in cake history from Anne Byrne, also known as the Cake Mix Doctor. Then, we'll join some of Louisiana's greatest chefs and bakers for a lesson in sugar blowing from master sugar sculptor Sidney Galpern. Finally, we'll visit the production facility of Gracious Bakery to learn more about the business of sweets and how to make a killer croissant. It's all about sweet talk on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Hey, I'm Anne Byrne. People know me as the Cake Mix Doctor, and my newest book is American Cake.
They say necessity is the mother of invention. Anne Byrne had a burning need to create a better cake for her own children using the shortcut of store-bought cake mix. Hence, her moniker, the Cake Mix Doctor. Anne's book, American Cake, takes readers back to the origins of cake baking in America. We sat down with Anne to hear firsthand where many of our more famous cakes originated and how they were invented in the first place. Anne, this is such a thrill and an honor to have a chance to sit down with you for the ultimate conversation about cake. And I would like to know, how in the world did you become known as the Cake Mix Doctor?
Well, after I was trained in France and wrote about food for 15, 20 years, I had three children, and they were small, and I reached for a box of cake mix in my pantry and decided I would doctor it up and make a homemade frosting. I wrote about it in the newspaper, and then that sort of gave everybody else license to start doing the same thing. I wrote a book, Cake Mix Doctor, and here I am today.
So, in your opinion, do you think it's all about the icing?
If you use a cake mix, it is all about the icing. I taught a lot of people in this country how to make a homemade frosting because, really, canned frosting from the supermarket is pretty terrible.
In your book, American Cake, one of the things that you discuss is where the word icing comes from. So, tell me about icing.
Icing is pretty interesting. You know, it all boils down to sugar, Poppy, and you know that. I mean, it's sort of like, where was sugar available in this country? I'll just backtrack just a second. You know, so much of our history of baking cakes in this country, and this book is all scratch recipes, by the way. It's not cake mix, but it's all scratch. And the history really boils down to, was sugar available? Was it near you? Could you afford it? And what did you do with it? So really, the first icings or frostings were really just a little bit of sugar, perhaps beaten with an egg white, simple meringue, thrown back on the cake, or even no egg white at all, the sugar thrown on the cake, put back in that hot oven, and it glossed the top of the cake, and it looked like ice. And that's where the word icing came from, that we use today. And of course, it's gotten much more elaborate than that.
I loved the way you defined American cake. You say that American cake is one part technique, one part history of homeland, one part available ingredients, and one part American spirit. Why does that make up American cake?
Because the people who came to our country brought their recipes from the homeland with them. They had to use ingredients that are available here, in our country. So they had to adapt a few things. If they made a jam cake, they used blackberries because they were growing wild across the middle of America. And the American spirit apart was because they could not rely just on that recipe from the homeland. They had to break some rules. The ingredients were different. The people who made American cake are a wonderful collage of countries, of backgrounds, and all of that contribution created the cake that we know today. And when times are tough and you don't have the ingredients that you want, you use what you have. And some of the best cakes in our country have come out of that time in history.
There was a time in America before baking powder and baking soda, important leavening agents existed. And there was something called emptins that were used?
Well, it was just the leftover residue in the yeast that was from beer making or brewing. So it was what people used as early yeast. Yeast cakes were very popular in Europe, and they had been, and those recipes came with Americans. And when beer was made here, cider was made here, any of that leftover yeasty residue, that was used in baking. The early American bakers were very resourceful. They used everything that they had. And then as our country got away from maybe the time-consuming yeast cakes, that's when potash and pearlash, which is the ash from burning hardwood trees, that was somehow thrown into a cake or a batter, and they saw that it lightened the cake and the bread. It was miraculous.
How did they think of that? Well, I don't know how you think of taking some ash and throwing it into a cake.
I don't know if you think of it. It was used in soap making. But what you think about the fire was not only the heat source, but it was also the cooking source. It was the oven. It was the stove. And burning ash could quite possibly have gotten into the batter of something. And the cook would have noticed that the outcome was a lot lighter and more spongy than her original version. So potash, pearlash, those were early leaveners, which then evolved into baking soda, cream of tartar, and then baking powder as we know it.
You go back as far as cakes in early America, dating back to 1650 to 1799. What were cakes like back then?
They were very simple, and they were from England. The recipe sources were mostly British. But what I thought was really interesting were the baking that was done by the Quakers in Pennsylvania and the first cheesecakes that were baked in our country. They were not New York-style cheesecakes, as we would see later, made with cream cheese. These were made with fresh curds, and these were dairy farmers. I love that. And then all sorts of variations on pound cakes. The carrot tea cake that's in the book, that is an early pound cake. And then there's a recipe out of South Carolina that I found that I just love, which is called a water cake. And that dates back to 1770. And that's all the recipe was called in this old diary, called a water cake. And when I looked at the ingredients, it being, you know, sugar and eggs and flour, I realized it was a sponge cake. But because sugar was sold by the block or the cone, you had to snip off a piece of it, dissolve it in hot water at the back of the stove or over the fire. And that's why it was called a water cake, because that hot sugar syrup went into the eggs, and then flour was added and made a sponge cake.
How and when was the American layer cake born?
It was born after 1865, when baking powder was available. And we should say, really, it was after the Civil War, because people were baking. If they were baking again, they were looking for quicker ways to bake. You would not be putting a cake in the oven and it could not consume so many costly ingredients. So baking powder had been invented in England in 1855. It came over to this country. And that's at the end of the 1800s is when most cooks started using baking powder. And it was a miraculous ingredient because the cakes could bake a lot faster. They didn't need as many eggs. It was more economical. and it really changed the texture of cake. It went from sort of that heavy fruitcake pancake to a much lighter crumb. And then so doing, with the just think about the evolution of the ovens and layers and how layer pans could fit into new ovens. You could bake more layers. You could make lighter cakes, and the layer cake was born.
Well, I was very interested to read in your book how broadly Louisiana figured in to cakes.
Oh, you all have such a fabulous food heritage here, and so many countries go into sort of your mix of flavors. And really, in New Orleans was so ahead of the curve. You know, the rest of the colonies were fighting and bickering, and you all were all down here cooking. You might have been fighting and bickering too, but you were cooking wonderful flavors, and you've got that heritage. It's no wonder you've got the dough bash and you've got the king cakes.
Leah Chase's butter cake? How did that end up in your book?
Because, well, I love Mrs. Chase. And then also because it was an example to me of a hard times cake, listening to her story growing up in Louisiana, poor, and how if you were going to bake one cake, it was going to be at Christmas. And if you baked the cake, you opened up your home and shared it with other people. And to me, that is the consummate of hospitality, is really putting other people first and their needs. And to me, that cake says it all, because you didn't have a lot, but when you did have it, you celebrated.
I believe the ultimate American celebration cake has to be the American wedding cake and the birthday cake. Would you talk to us about that tradition?
Yeah, well, you know, wedding cakes have changed through the years. They really were originally fruit cakes, and that changed with the wedding of Queen Victoria. And after that, not only the weddings, but also the wedding cake itself became white. But, you know, white cakes were only you could only make them if you had white sugar and also white flour. So flour was not always bleached. And the bleaching process of flour came about as a way of sanitizing flour, but also as a way to show its purity. So it was really revered, especially in something like a wedding cake. The wedding cake being white was a symbol that you had the money to pay for bleached flour and white sugar. It's so interesting now that we're completely away from that. You know, we're baking with unbleached flour. And I think birthday cakes, I've found in this book that they're very regional. A cake that I didn't grow up with is the Wellesley fudge cake, which is out of Massachusetts. And that is a great chocolate layer cake. I mean, it's fantastic. But that's a birthday cake in New England. Everyone loves the Mother Ann's shaker cake that's in the book with the peach jam between the layers. That's a New England birthday cake.
Aside from those celebrations, then there's also Sunday cakes and funeral cakes.
Very much so. And I think maybe more in the South, and definitely here in New Orleans. Cakes lend themselves to breaking a fast, related to church, church suppers, church lunches, church raffles. Cakes are part of so many celebrations, civic as well as related to church. And I found that true with the Louisiana syrup cake when I talked to Corinne Cook in Baton Rouge. Also, I think cakes, especially in the South, have always been large. So cakes have been a way to feed a lot of people, a big family, a church supper, much more so than a pie.
Well, Anne, if I'd known you were coming, I would have baked a cake. But I'm so grateful you came anyway.
Well,
and I hope
Poppy,
anytime that you come our way, you take the opportunity to sit down with us on Louisiana Eats. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Ann Byrne, the Cake Mix Doctor.
We ought to bake a sunshine cake. It does more good than a big thick steak.
Start with a tablespoon of trouble, then add a smile and let it bubble up.
When we come back from a short break, we'll take a lesson in sugar blowing from master sugar sculptor Sidney Galpern. Stay tuned.
Fresh tears, a pound or two of pleasure.
Kind words, you needn't use a measure, cup.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine, overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City. In downtown New Orleans, a restored 19th century brick building is home to the New Orleans Glassworks and Printmaking Studio. The space is over 25,000 square feet, housing enormous glass-blowing furnaces that can reach up to 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit. Several yards from the raging inferno, a much smaller fire is lit as Chef Tori McPhail brings a giant pot of crawfish to a boil.
Okay. You ready for a beer yet? Just slack it, Poppy.
Chef Tori and his team are preparing a crawfish boil lunch for a group of prominent chefs from the Commander's family, Brennan's, and Gambino's, to name just a few. They're gathered for a day-long crash course in sugar blowing, the art of creating sugar sculptures with tools similar to those used in glass blowing.
My name's Tori McPhail. I am the executive chef of Commander's Palace Restaurant.
Tori, what made you want to come and participate in this sugar blowing event today?
So oddly enough, we're blowing sugar today, but actually the whole thing got started because of chocolate.
Chocolate? Yeah. Tell me about
that. I pulled up like 6 months ago, and my dear, dear friend Juan Carlos Gonzalez, who is the executive chef of Sobu, was in the front seat. And they had, we're next door right now to Bittersweet Patisserie next door. And so they had an Albert Ooster chocolate thing going on there. I was like, all right, cool. I'm going to check out what's happening in the world of chocolate today. So we pulled up, and the parking spot that was open was right in front of New Orleans Glassworks. All right, so here we are. We're dressed in our commander's gear. Juan Carlos has got the Sobu gear on. We get out. We pop in. We start tasting through these amazing European chocolates. We're having espresso. They had glasses of Prosecco. And so we had, like, I don't know, six of those. And we're hanging out, we're enjoying ourselves, having a good time. We walk out, and who comes out the front door but Miss Jeannie? And she says, hey, come here, you know, come check this out. So we're walking around the glass shop, and we start talking about chocolate and da-da-da. She's like, well, hey, look, have you ever thought about blowing sugar? I'm like, man, I always wanted to do that. Let's go. She says, well, you put together the group of chefs, right? You figure out the time, and we're going to get some people in here and teach you and the whole Commander's Palace restaurant group what's going on with blowing sugar. And so here we are today. We said, hey, look, you know what? We wanted a great lunch. Let's throw everybody a crawfish boil, right? We get to understand what's happening in their world. We get to understand what's happening in ours. I mean, I just think it's fascinating, no matter if it's food, which is what I'm obviously very geeky about and very, very into. But guys that do other types of creative arts, I think is just fascinating. So to be able to walk in here and see these guys using glass as their medium and express their amazing creativity, I think it's damn cool. You know, I really do. It's great.
All right, thank you guys so much for coming or from returning if you were here earlier. I'm Cindy Galper and I'm the instructor here. I specialize in blown sugar and blown ice malt, which is what we are about to do. The chefs here who we have from various restaurants and bakeries around New Orleans, we are going to do, it's a blown sugar crab. So his body is blown and then his arms are going to be all hand sculpted. So that's what I'm about to show them now. If you guys have any questions, feel free to ask me or anyone here or him in the lighter shirt.
Leading the workshop today is visiting master sugar sculptor Sidney Galpern. I asked Sidney how at the age of just 21, she was already a world-renowned sugar blowing instructor.
So I started early. I started when I was 12 years old. I've been doing this for about 9 years. And I actually started out with just having a bakery. So I wanted to make cakes. I wanted to make confections. I was also teaching on the side of that as well, and just doing holding classes and things like that. But both ends of that, the bakery and the teaching, both got very busy. And I kind of had to choose, do I want to stay home and have the bakery full time, or do I want to travel full time and hold classes and teach at conventions? And I love teaching. I love making cakes too, but I love teaching. That's what I really, really like to do. So that's what I do now full time.
For people who have maybe never heard that word before, explain what ice-melt is.
Okay, so ice-melt is a sugar substitute. So it's going to work a lot the same way as if you were to just melt down lollipops or Jolly Ranchers. There's a lot of different things you can do with it. Ice-melt is very versatile. You can pour it into molds and make any shape basically that you can think of. You can stretch it out and make ribbons. You can sculpt it into sculptures. You can then take that pulled ice-melt and do blown sugar or blown ice-melt. And that is very similar to glass blowing, except it's actually edible. One of my favorite things that I've done is I did a bust of Edgar Allan Poe that I hand sculpted. I love him. So that was one of my favorite things that I've done. But, you know, really there's so many different ways that you can use it, with blowing, with sculpting. It's a hard candy, except it's a sugar-free substitute. So what that means is it's used instead of real sugar, because real sugar is very susceptible to humidity. So at home in Florida, and just like here in New Orleans, it is going to be very, very humid all the time. So if you were to use real sugar, it's going to get very sticky and drippy and can actually break down. So what ice-melt does is it preserves your piece. It's actually going to be a lot less susceptible to the humidity, and it's just going to stay beautiful for months rather than sugar, which can melt very quickly.
What are the similarities between sugar blowing and glass blowing?
It's really similar, actually. I was very surprised. I've done a little bit of glass blowing before. The main difference of it is that you can't touch glass. It's way too hot. That would not be good. You can touch the ice malt once it's cooled down a little bit, not when it's liquid, because it's about 300 degrees. But you can be a little bit more hands-on with the ice malt than you can with the sugar. But as far as the blowing and the shaping and the way that you can manipulate it and the way that it dries and sets up, it is very, very similar.
So I'm pretty happy with this. I don't want to go too big, because the more you stretch this out, the thinner it gets, right? Because you are working with a solid amount of ice-melt, so it's not like you're adding more and more to it. So the more that you stretch it out and puff it out, the thinner these walls are going to get and the more fragile it's going to get.
Tell me a little bit about how you approach teaching people, because the chefs probably have little to no exposure to this, I suspect.
Yeah, definitely. It was awesome, because we have a couple people that have used ice-melt a little bit, but we also have some people who have never touched ice-melt before. So I like to build up a little bit. So we start a little bit more simple, and then we build up onto the advanced techniques. And I try and teach it so that everyone can learn. So a lot of asking questions and back and forth. You know, I don't just want to talk at people. I want them to be engaged in it and really interested, because it is so interesting. There's so many things to this.
So what did these professional chefs, all at the top of their fields, learn from the day-long course? We asked them.
I'm Rebecca Brettle. I work at Gambino's Bakery, and I work at the New Orleans location. I'm a wedding cake decorator, and I wanted to try something different and new that I haven't seen here in the city. Never done anything like it before, so everything is new. I've learned everything new today. It's fantastic. Doing some bows and some cool things, just, you know, working with the sugar itself. So,
how you doing? My name is Eric Pirelli. I'm the pastry chef over at Brennan's.
Eric, why did you want to come here today?
I came to basically improve my skills with sugar and to learn some new techniques.
What did you learn new today?
Patience. I learned patience with the pulling and allowing it to cool faster instead of rushing things.
I'm Angela St. Romain. I work for Gambino's Bakery in Baton Rouge.
Angela, why were you interested in coming here today?
Well, about 20 years ago, I unsuccessfully tried to do pulled sugar. With the humidity here in Louisiana, it was just impossible. And I was working with a classically trained chef from Paris, and I was his apprentice, and he made this beautiful cake, and within an hour, with all our humidity, it was weeping, and so we were both weeping with the cake. And when this came up, I said, you know, I really want to try this again, because I failed once, so I don't want to give up. And so here I am, and this is wonderful.
So what did you learn today?
Well, I tell you what, the isomalt is a lot more forgiving than just going with natural sugars and getting it down with corn syrup, which is the method that we used. So, you know, the new techniques that are coming in the culinary industry are just wonderful and really make our jobs a lot more fun and creative and easy.
Master sugar sculptor Sidney Galpern and some of Louisiana's best chefs and bakers at the New Orleans Glassworks and Printmaking Studio. To say that chocolate is in Tarik Hanna's blood is not far from the truth. His childhood in Nigeria was spent a short distance from the National Cocoa Processing Plant, where the aroma of roasting cocoa beans filled the air. After graduating from boarding school in England at the age of 15, Tarik moved to Detroit, intending to study architecture, but soon found himself in culinary school, where his passion for design met pastry. In the spring of 2007, Tarik joined forces with New Orleans native restaurateur Joel Dondas to create a one-of-a-kind pastry experience, Sucre. Tarik has revisited his passion for chocolate by developing his very own proprietary blend with master chocolatiers in Switzerland.
Well, actually, it was a trip that's been 10 years in the making.
Ah.
I was supposed to have gone to Switzerland to Felchlin, who is this incredible, true small artisan producer. And I've used their product for several years, for probably the last 15 years. I've used Felchlin chocolate. Beautiful product, incredible people. And I finally decided that I did need to take a little bit of a break from work and go do some work.
And so what did you leave with? What have you come away from that experience with?
It gave me a much deeper rooted passion, understanding, and admiration for every single thing that goes into the product that they make. When you think about the big producers, when you buy commercial chocolate, when I say commercial, be it Felchlin or a Valrhona or a Barry Callebaut or something of that nature, you imagine these monstrous factories churning out tens of thousands of pounds of chocolate an hour. But when you saw the smaller scale that Felchlin produce on, at a much more frequent pace and a much more frequent time frame, it gave you a much greater appreciation of how much they produce and also the freshness and the attention of the product. Chocolate is primarily, when you think of a chocolate bar, it's primarily made up of three ingredients: cocoa solids, cocoa butter, cocoa fat. So if you have a nice piece of chocolate that's shiny, you break it, it snaps. You put it in your mouth, it melts and it's not granular. That's because you have great crystallization. Or if you have a dull piece of chocolate that when you break it, it just seems soft and it seems gritty in your mouth, you have bad crystallization. So the study of crystallization, which is a very new study considering, is probably one of the most dynamic elements of what makes the structure of chocolate good or bad. So Manfred Suter, who is the gentleman in question, every single batch of chocolate they make, every 6 hours, every single batch is tested. No matter whether they're doing a very high-end single bean origin chocolate or they're doing a utility blend, every batch of chocolate gets the same attention around the clock. The chocolate that we actually made was made from a brand new bean from the Creole family. So we took this bean and we went through various stages of roasting. We then went to the conching process. And Falkland still use three of the original conch machines that were first invented. The conch is basically a grinding process. Mm-hmm. It's a slow grinding. Imagine taking a rolling pin back and forth over a very long period of time, very slowly. So when we go through the process of determining what roast we want to use, and we go through the milling and the grinding, we then go through the conching process, where it's a combination of taking the raw solids and the sugar, and then it's slowly back and forth over several hours. Several hours, I'm talking 12, 24, 48, up to 72 hours. But what we did was, starting at 20 hours, we started tasting, and we tasted every 6 hours. It's incredible what happens in a 6 hour period. The profile of the chocolate changes completely. So imagine this machine runs constantly for 48 hours, grinding, making it smoother, developing new characteristics, bringing out the natural fruitiness, the berryness, the citrus, whatever might come up. And until you hit that point where you know what you want the final product to be, you stop. What we found to be the magic number was 48 hours. We could have gone further. I have a chocolate that I use right now from Falkland that's conched for 72 hours.
Wow.
And again, you have people who know their craft, and then you have people who, they are their craft. Mm-hmm. These people are their craft. They understand from just the first sight of a bean and the first tasting of the raw bean what the end result is going to be.
Chef Tarek Hanna of Sucre.
Why do my heart still beat? What makes the soul come out of me? Somebody's really gotta tell me. What makes the music sound so sweet?
What sweet revolution occurred in Louisiana in 1795? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What sweet revolution occurred in Louisiana in 1795? It was the sweet revolution brought about by Étienne de Boré, the first man to granulate sugar. Once the mystery of granulation was solved, the worldwide demand for sugarcane and the granulated sweet stuff began, making Louisiana a very lucrative place to live. De Boré was so revered for his discovery that when Louisiana became part of the United States following the Louisiana Purchase, he was appointed the first mayor of New Orleans. I'm Poppy Tooker, and granulated sugar makes for some good Louisiana Eats.
Sugar man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue corn, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Silver magic ships you carry.
Opening a French candy store in the Crescent City is by no means a stretch. After all, from pralines to king cakes, we New Orleanians have a deep appreciation for French sweets. It's less common, however, to find confections that date back to the reign of Louis XIII. Kylie La Riviere is a purveyor of fine French candy at La Riviere on Magazine Street. And upon our visit to her confesserie, she immediately directed us to her most prized pralines, which originated in the 17th century.
I think we should probably begin with the oldest candy that I carry, because it was created in 1636 by the chef for the Duke of Plaisir's praline. So he was known for having a very talented chef, for liking beautiful, flamboyant, very gay parties. He loved to entertain, and his chef created this candy, an almond roasted and then caramelized in sugar. The name of the chef was Clément Jalousot. He took that caramelized almond, put it in beautiful boxes, and brought it to the women of the court of Louis XIII. And they called it the praline, after the Duke. And it took off from there. From the court, it became well known. Other chefs learned how to make it. The recipe remained secret, but it's not very complicated. And French settlers brought this candy with them, the Creoles, brought it to Haiti and other Caribbean islands, and then to the south of the United States, where they tried to recreate it, but they didn't have almonds, so they used the pecan. And that's how the Louisiana praline was born.
And so it actually then, in Louisiana, becomes a round sort of a crispy little cake of a candy, instead of the individual pecans being candied, which, of course, we see that in Louisiana, too, but not quite like that, not with that crunchy, crunchy brown sugar sort of a taste.
Exactly, exactly, right. And one of the reasons that I love this candy and I'm so devoted to it is because I think it came to New Orleans in two ways. I know that it came to the South via the Creole settlers that came from France to the Caribbean to the south of the United States, and so they brought this recipe with them. But it also came via boat up the Mississippi, because it was known to be made by this house. This is the signature house that created this confiserie, and it was known in the court. So it probably came as a gift to New Orleans, and it was also brought via recipe, and then the recipe was changed because the almond, which is in it, is ubiquitous in Europe, but it is not plentiful here. But what is plentiful is the pecan, and the pecan doesn't taste very good when it's roasted as heavily as an almond does, but if you cook it in the same copper pot with cane sugar and cream, it comes out amazingly delicious, like the Louisiana praline. And so there, this is the beginning and the inspiration for that Louisiana praline.
And what is your next candy in the shop that you
like to share with
you? Yes, exactly.
Well, there's Batiste de Cambrai, which is really near and dear to my heart because of the family that makes it, very similarly to the history of the praline. This candy has been made since 1880. It's a very simple, hard candy. It is made with sugar and glucose syrup, and they cook it in copper pots again to caramelize it. And there was an accident. The accident was that one of the apprentices whipped the candy too much, and it became opaque instead of caramelized brown. And they called it a batisse. And that's how the candy came by its name. Batisse means mistake.
So it's the mistake of Cambrai.
That's right.
But I guess it was a really great mistake.
It was an awesome mistake.
What year did they make the mistake?
1880-something.
Incredible. And they're still making them today,
and
too.
And they're still making them today. There are two two companies that make them. There's Depinois, which is the one that I carry. And then there's Afshin. And Depinois is special, I believe, because it's family-owned. It's been family-owned from the beginning. They are a group of seven people who make this 4 days out of the week, and this is the first time they've been in the United States.
Oh, that's fantastic.
They're a great example of a company that braved getting through the FDA.
And so how did that work exactly?
I helped them. It was something we did collaboratively. I met with them. I met the family. We discussed the FDA process, which really means filling out a lot of paperwork and going through a lot of red tape. And the thing that really helped me and helped them is that the past Minister of Agriculture retired in the United States and started a business where he helps. He's a Euro consultant where he helps cheese and winemakers bring their products through FDA, and he agreed to help this candy company. And they have a simple, basic list of ingredients, and that helps a lot. The fact that these candies are artisanal, that they're made with natural ingredients, there are not dyes, there are not preservatives, there are no chemicals to be translated and checked and tested, makes a big difference.
What has the reaction been of people to these unusual things that you've brought?
They love it. They love it. I think the first time I sold candy, it was to a woman. She had a shocking reaction. She saw those pralines on a shelf and she said, oh my God. My mother used to eat those pralines, and my mother passed away 25 years ago, and she was French, and I've never seen them since she was alive, and it was a very moving reaction. But then, you know, sometimes it's just, wow, these are really delicious.
Kylie La Riviere, owner of La Riviere Confesserie.
I call my sugar candy cause she's so doggone sweet. I call my sugar candy cause she's so doggone sweet. Morning, noon, and midnight, she's my special treat.
Artisan bakeries have experienced rapid growth across the country. Here in Louisiana, there are many places to try when in search of the platonic ideal in pastries. We visited the fragrant headquarters of Gracious Bakery, situated on the border of Mid-City in New Orleans, where one of the bakers was poised to begin folding dough for delectable croissants. Before observing that process, we had a quick chat with owner and executive pastry chef, Megan Foreman.
We started in our location on South Jeff Davis about 4 years ago in the Woodward building. And my husband and I started the company and just wanted to make sure that the idea would float and that people would come. It's kind of far away from everything else. A lot of people started by saying, oh, this is in no man's land. But it really is a crossroads of a lot of different neighborhoods. A lot of people pass through and on their way to something else. And so it really has become a destination location with the help of all these wonderful people that work with us and do amazing, really wonderful things. And so we, I guess 2 years ago now, decided to expand and create a commissary so that we could do wholesale products and serve more locations as we grew.
What made you become a baker in the first place?
I was in college and I was trying to understand what could I do that I really loved doing. And in liberal arts, I was taking French and English, and I thought, well, what kind of job does this translate to? And I saw a news segment about a culinary school, and it just hit me that would be something that I would love to do. I'm a pretty active person, and I love having my hands in things, and I like instant results. So all those things added up, I thought would be good. I had no idea what I was in for, but it's been a wonderful surprise and a learning experience like I never would have imagined.
So you went to culinary school. Which one did you go to?
I did. I went to New England Culinary Institute in Vermont, in Montpelier, and did a savory externship. And then I thought, well, let me round myself out and do a pastry one in New York. And so I moved to New York and did that. And then it just changed everything for me. What I loved so much about it was this never-ending education. Like, there's just so much to learn all the time. There's so many new things. It's such an exciting creative field.
Tell us a little bit about the life of a pastry chef. Long days, early hours. Tell me what a day in the life of Megan Foreman's like.
Well, the day now is much better than it used to be. But when we first opened, it was early morning. The bakers get in at about 4, and that's when they start their day. And we have different shifts. The ones who start at 4 end at 12. But, you know, when you're an owner, you're kind of always on. You're always taking care of your baby. So, you know, even when you're off, you're thinking about it and you're checking in and you're making sure everything's going well. But I mean, that is the biggest thing, is having this group of people that everyone does their job so well that I don't have to worry. And I'm really lucky, you know, with that.
Out of all the products that you make here, what is your guilty pleasure? What's the thing that you sneak a little bit for yourself and you just can't help it?
Well, we were talking about that the other day. Like, people were talking about, what is your spirit animal? And I was like, well, my spirit animal in the dessert world is definitely chocolate mousse. It's like, that's simple thing, but it's so delicious, and it really showcases the quality of the chocolate, you know, that we use. And I could sit, that will be like, if it's my last meal kind of thing, like, I'll take a bowl of that to finish off. But, you know, that really is the thing that I would go back to over and over again.
Next, Megan led us into the kitchen at Gracious, where the dough was prepped and ready to be laminated, the process that gives croissants those flaky layers.
My name is Summer Veach, and I'm the pastry chef at Gracious Bakery. I am going to laminate some croissant dough. I start with a block of dough that we have sheeted out to the size of a sheet tray. And then I take a block of butter that is about half the size, and I'm gonna layer it in between. So laminating is just the process of folding dough over butter and creating layers of dough and butter. So I have a sandwich here of dough and butter, and the temperature is what's really important when you're dealing with croissant dough. It's really, really cold. You want it to be as cold as possible. And the whole book, I mean, this is a 5,000 gram book of dough, so it's quite a bit. It's gonna make about 70 croissants. And there's different styles of turning. Different techniques to get different numbers of layers in your dough. So we do two four folds in our dough. So this is my first fold, and what I'm doing is I'm folding both ends of the dough to meet somewhere around the middle. It doesn't have to be the middle. And then I'm gonna fold it again to create a book, and what that does is now I have more layers of dough and more layers of butter. I wanna say that this particular style, we have about 27. Layers at the end of the day.
Sounds from the kitchen at Gracious Bakery.
Sweets for my sweets, sugar for my honey. Your tasty kiss thrills me so. Sweets for my sweets, sugar for my honey. I'll never ever let you go.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Tune in next week when we celebrate carnival time in the Crescent City.
A costume is a must. You cannot walk out the door on Mardi Gras Day without a costume.
No, I'm a firm believer. None of this purple, green, and gold rugby shirt.
Yes.
That's
no.
Lame. Let your inhibitions run wild, or if there's something you always wanted to be or dress up as, do it.
On Thursday, March the 23rd, Louisiana Eats is teaming up with French Market Coffee for our next celebrity chef dinner, benefiting our home at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Join us for an evening of fun and fine dining as Chef Chris Montero of the Napoleon House prepares a three-course meal right before your very eyes with wines paired by Bin 428, a Magazine Street wine shop in New Orleans. To see the evening's menu and buy tickets, visit my website, poppytooker.com. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.